Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Melsted versus Kovac. For the appellant is Mr. Terry Pechota, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellees, Mr. James Robinholt, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and Mr. Jack Durhagopian, an attorney also from Sioux Falls. It's my understanding, Mr. Robinholt, you'll go first and speak for 10 minutes. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And then Mr. Durhagopian, you will speak for the remaining 10 minutes. Okay, very well. Mr. Pechota, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, please, Court. Mr. Durhagopian. Your Honors, this case emanated out of a motor vehicle accident that occurred in July of 1998 out near the Coffee Cup truck stop east of Vermilion there at that intersection of I-29 and Highway 50, I think it is. On that morning, Kathleen was going to work. She worked at a brokerage house in Sioux Falls, and Mr. Kovac, driving a Raider Industries truck, pulled out from the Coffee Cup, and she hit the truck. It was in hit the truck in the front, sustained really quite catastrophic injuries. She has reflex sympathetic dystrophy. Really has become global, and there's really not much question here that she has permanent and permanent personal injuries in this particular case. The action was filed in July of 01 in Union County in Elk Point there. There was extensive discovery in the case, and the trial was set for October 5th, 2004. There was a mediation in August of 2004, and the parties were quite far apart in this case. I think there was an offer of $125 by the insurance company, and the plaintiff's appellant in this case was like at $1.5. They did give her an advance at that time. There was some, they wanted her to do a IME, and there were some expenses involved with that. So they did give her a $5,000 advance that has some relevance to this case as I get into this, as you will see. Huge medical bills. At the time that the settlement took place, it was about $125,000. They're now about up to $150,000. The trial was set for October 5th, 2004, there in Union County. And the parties were horrendously far apart, and it didn't look like there was going to be a settlement in the case. On 10-1-04, which was a Friday, Mr. Durhagopian, who was representing Kathleen at the time, sent a letter offering to settle for $750,000. And that, about the first four exhibits of both the affidavit of Kathleen Malstad and the deposition of Mr. Durhagopian set forth, the relevant correspondence in this case. But that was a $750,000 offer. On 10-4, the Saturday, the first was a Friday, the second was a Saturday, third was a Sunday, fourth was a Monday. On Monday, there was a letter that was sent by Mr. Durhagopian to Mr. Robinow indicating that they would settle for $500,000. And at that particular point in time, on Monday, there was a phone conversation between Kathleen Malstad and Mr. Durhagopian, and some of what, there's an exhibit to Mr. Durhagopian's deposition It's a partial transcript that there doesn't seem to be any dispute about. And at that time, Ms. Malstead indicated to Mr. Deregopian, she says, what did you offer? And he said $500,000. She says, that isn't what I told you to offer. She said, I told you that you could go up to 600, you could come down to 650,000 if they would come up substantially. I did not tell you that you could settle for $500,000. And evidently there was some conversation there about, you know, about what she wanted. And she says, you go back in there and you get $500,000 plus the medical bills and plus the cost of legal fees. Mr. Deregopian wrote a confirming letter of that conversation to Catherine Malstead at that particular time. And this, that letter then sets forth, and this was on Monday, in the late morning that that correspondence took place. That is the last tangible proof that we have of any authority to settle in this particular case.
With the $500,000 plus the medical bills plus the attorney's fees,
right,
wouldn't that exceed the $750,000
well,
that was offered?
It probably would, Your Honor. But that's what.
So in the context of things, that's no concession on her part
well,
at all.
Well, I don't know what she was talking about. Is there wasn't any discussion about the exact amount, whether you know she wanted all the medical bills or I don't know that, Your Honor. But if in fact there was 500 plus you know the contingency and the medical bills, it would be quite a, you know probably a little bit.
Was this a disputed liability case?
I do not feel that it was a disputed liability case. But if you look at Mr. Deregopian's letter, when he was talking to Mr. Robineau about settling the case, there was this. He went through and valued the case, and then he did reduce it for contributory negligence and maybe some pre-existing injuries. Of course, Mr. Deregopian indicated that he thought that this particular injury did actually, caused a very serious pre-aggravation of any, you know, of any pre-existing injury that might
have been there. Was there ever a determination by an expert or someone in mediation or anything like this as to what a ballpark fair offer or fair settlement figure would be?
Well, they did have Dr. Ralph Brown gave an opinion, was ready to testify in this case.
He's the plaintiff's expert,
right? He's the plaintiff's expert. There was a mediation in this case that took place in August, and that's where this the parties are relatively far apart. The mediation didn't last very long because the parties were so far apart. But as far as any independent review of this to say this is what I believe this case is worth, there was none of that. It was just the two advocates on the side. At that particular time, there was no authority to settle for anything. You know, at most, the authority was to settle for $500,000. At 5:05 p.m., there was Mr. Deregopian indicates that the case was settled for $325,000 that he had secured oral approval or authority from Kathleen to settle the case. That, of course, is vehemently opposed and denied by Ms. Malstead.
So doesn't that come down to a question of credibility for the court?
Well, Your Honor, I will get into that a little bit. There is a, you know, I assume that there is a little bit of credibility problem here as to, clearly, there's no dispute that we just have, if this was all done orally, as I said, the last tangible proof was that letter that was sent on Monday. Okay. So we come down, the case is settled. Mr. Derek Opian settles the case for $325,000. Now, there was a motion to enforce the settlement agreement in this case. The motion for summary judgment was denied, and then there was a hearing on August 9th of 2005 before Judge Jensen on this matter. Judge Jensen relied upon two affidavits submitted by Catherine Malstead, some correspondence that was attached to that. That's before the court. He relied upon a deposition of Jack Deregopian, and he relied upon a deposition of Melissa Larson, who was a clerk of courts, basically just saying that, on October 5th, the trial was not held, and because we had been advised at about 5 o'clock that there was not going to be any trial in this particular case. So then, that's important to your question, Mr. Chief Justice, because I believe that since the stature of this case is that it was decided on the deposition and affidavits, that this is before this court on a de novo determination, and consequently then the question comes down to what should be the standard of proof in that particular kind of case. Now, we have some particular cases out of this court dealing with this situation. However, none that really decide or talk about the burden of proof in the case. We know under Northwest Realty there's no right under a retainer to settle a case. It talks about the high standard of the bar to act in this case. It talks about important agreements being in writing. But it also says, as my brethren have pointed out in their briefs, that there's no requirement that it be in writing, although the policy should perhaps have dictated that they be in writing. Now, other jurisdictions, of course, have dealt with this, and I've cited some of those in my brief. They talk about the attorney's authority not being presumed and the burden upon the party who's saying that there's an agreement to show that by clear and convincing authority, by clear and unequivocal authority from the attorney, that he has a right to do this. And the standard and burden of proof is a clear and convincing authority, clear and convincing evidence of this particular case.
Was that used by the trial court?
No, it wasn't, Your Honor. The trial court really didn't get into that, the time. So,
was that raised to the trial court at the time?
We cited, I'm not sure if it was or not, Your Honor. We were relying upon the cases, of course, out of the Supreme Court of this state. Perez, we felt that Perez and some of the other cases dealt with this situation and that they were sufficient to not enforce this particular agreement in the case. I think one case that's really quite on point in this case is a case I cited in my brief, Ottawa County Commissioners. It's out of Ohio, and they deal with the situation, generally as we have it. And it says, where it is claimed that the express authority to act in such matters was verbally conferred by the client, clear and convincing evidence is required to establish the fact. A mere preponderance of even the credible evidence is insufficient. And it goes on to state that, I did just, if I could just quote one more part on that. Whatever an agent may say about his specific authority to act for his principal, the law requires more to establish that authority than his own bare statements. Even apart from their hearsay nature, such assurance of standing alone can never be satisfactorily proof of the agent's express or special authority. That's basically what we have here in this case. Now,
we have all kinds of cases that are settled in this state on the courthouse steps. We still have a pretty genial bar, and a lot of things are done by phone calls and handshakes. Are you saying that should all be cast aside and it now has to be in writing?
Well, we are becoming a more complex society, Your Honor. things are more litigative. I think in a situation like this, where you have a attorney-client relationship that was I would say in this case tenuous. There was difficulty getting along. I think that, you know, by and large, we have a very, we do have a handshake bar probably. And a lot of times, situations like that, you know, a handshake will do. But, you know, there are times when, as we're dealing with in this case, where that is not sufficient enough. I think the court needs to be definitive about the standard of proof in a case like this, and if there's any disagreement in a case of this magnitude, then I think that simply statements between the attorney and the client are not sufficient when you're trying to when the outcome is that a case is settled for, you know, way below what the client wants and deserves. The client is the captain of the ship. There's no question about that. And so not only are we just dealing with oral statements back and forth in this case, but as I said in my brief, there's a background of unfavorable circumstances here. Mr. Deragopian, in his deposition, agreed that the settlement was very awkward in this case. It was contrary to his client, to his policy of having his client in the same room. He had trouble communicating with her. There was allegations that there was profanity back and forth, which Mr. Deragopian, you know, apologized for. And he indicated nobody in his office got along with her, that there was a debate between him and her, you know, up until the last minute as to whether this matter should go to trial. She disagreed with settling this case. You know, his position was that it was settled at 5 o'clock when the trial was supposed to set the next day. And of course, I think, and I would remiss if I wouldn't point out the fact that Mr. Deragopian stood to gain about $100,000+ out of the settlement in this case. So that's, you know, when you look at credibility, come on. I think that his credibility is as much called into question in this case as Ms. Melstad. I mean, she had the reason that she could not settle this case is that if they were going to settle for $325,000, that she was left with about $75,000 for pain and suffering. She had a job at Dean Witter, Morgan Stanley in Sioux Falls. She hasn't worked since that time. She had future medicals that are outstanding. She's now on about 9 pain medications, wage losses, pain and suffering, loss of quality of life, $75,000. She couldn't do it.
From the time of the handshake settlement between the counsel, how much time elapsed before your client repudiated it?
She indicated that when she was told on the fourth, she disagreed that this case was going to be, that should have been settled for that amount. She called, go back a little bit, she had been in contact with the insurance companies in this case even before Mr. Deragopian was involved. She knew the adjuster, Al McGrattan. She knew, she'd called him many times. She called, and her affidavit indicates it, and it's unrebutted, that she called them on October 6th and told them that she was not going to accept this particular settlement. On October 7th, Jack Deragopian writes her and tells her not to be talking to Jim Robinault and to Al McGrattan in this case because the case was settled. On October 8th, he writes to her and tells her, "Listen, you know, evidently you told Kathy or my paralegal that you were not going to sign this agreement." So, contrary to what's been argued by the appellees in this case, I mean, she never indicated to them that she was going to go along with the settlement in this particular case. She was a layman. I think another thing that I'd like the court to look at, this contingency fee agreement that was in this case, in a paragraph 4. It says, no settlement shall be made without approval of all the parties hereto. Your Honors, in this particular case, there was no preponderant or clear or convincing evidence that she gave them authority to settle her case in this case.
Would we have to find, though, that the findings of fact by the trial court were clearly erroneous?
No, I think that you can, I think it's a de novo review. In this particular, that's what the court made its ruling on. Kathleen did testify at the August 9th hearing, just basically foundation for the affidavits that she submitted, and just to say that her medical bills now had gone up from $120,000 to
$150,000. Mr. Picciotta, don't the recent amendments to Rule 52 require clearly erroneous review, even though it's documentary evidence?
I think on a de novo, I think you could decide this. I don't think
I'm saying under Rule 52, under the amendments to Rule 52, we're now required to give clearly erroneous review, even if it's documentary evidence.
No.
Well, that's what the new rule says, the last revisions to it.
Well, but I'm not sure that would apply. You're saying that you have to apply the clearly erroneous review standard to documentary evidence in the case?
That's what the new rule says.
Well, I don't know when those went into effect, if they were in effect.
It's a few years ago.
Okay, well, then, you know, it really doesn't make any difference in this case, but there's no clear and convincing evidence in this case that the case was settled, Your Honor.
Thank you. Your time has expired, Mr. Picciotta. Mr. Robinholt, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Good morning. I'm kind of the odd person out here. I wasn't in on any of the discussions between the plaintiff and her counsel as to what led up to the settlement. All I can tell the court this morning is that I was fully prepared to go to trial. I had all my banker's boxes full of medical records and other evidence ready to go in the back of my car, and I was ready to go to Elk Point to try this case when I got a call from Mr. Daragopian shortly after 5 o'clock on the day before trial, saying that if I could get another $25,000 in addition to the $300,000, that my clients had already offered to settle the case, that the matter could be settled. Whereupon I did call my clients in Saskatchewan and did obtain that authority to settle the case, whereupon I called Mr. Daragopian back and was informed that the case was settled. It wasn't until probably 10 days after October 5th that I learned for certain that there was a problem with the case. The next day, the day of trial, I went ahead and drafted the release and the stipulation to dismiss the complaint and counterclaim ordered the check for settlement from my client, just like I do in most every other case that I'm involved in that does not go to trial. And it was not until approximately the 18th of October that I learned that Mrs. Milstead was not going to settle the case, or was not going to follow through with the settlement. I was in contact with Mr. Daragopian in the meantime regarding the cleaning up of things that needed to be done, etc. And as far as that goes, I think that Judge Jensen, after the motion to enforce the settlement was made, had the opportunity to view the witnesses, to ask them questions as to what was going on, and mainly the witnesses were Ms. Milstead. He made a determination based upon his observations and his experience as a trial judge after hearing the evidence at, and actually there were three different motions.
Now, Mr. Picciotta says it's all by deposition. You're apparently contesting that the trial court did make credibility decisions on live witnesses?
There was testimony that was offered. Now, I don't know why I didn't put this in the record, but after Mr. Daragopian withdrew And I think that was in the late part of 2004, early part of 2005. Ms. Melsted did appear with Mary Ann Giebink at a hearing where there was some discussion and some back and forth. And I believe that was in, I believe it was in March of 2005, where she obtained a continuance on the hearing of the motion. And immediately after obtaining that, she fired Ms. Giebink, who, and then I think she went on to hire Mr. Pachota at that point. So Judge Jensen had the opportunity to view at least the plaintiff in this action on more than one occasion in his courtroom, and based upon that, made a specific finding that her testimony was not credible, and that Mr. Derhagopian's via deposition, and also I believe there was a hearing on October 12th of last year on Mr. Derhagopian's attorney lien, that in fact his testimony was credible.
What did the court base that on, her, that she was not credible?
I believe it was the fact that on at least one occasion prior to August 9th, 2005, she had showed up and I seem to recall that there were two hearings before that where she had obtained continuances and had based her request for a continuance on the fact that her lawyer was not up to speed and that they needed time to get prepared. Because, and if I recall correctly, and I think it's in my brief, the original hearing on my motion was set for January of 2005. There was a continuance obtained on that, and I believe Ms. Giebink showed up in June of 2000. I believe it was June of 2005. So the judge had ample opportunity to observe and to evaluate Ms. Melsted's credibility.
But when he talked about credibility, he was talking about her assertions in the affidavit, right? Her assertions as to what happened.
Yes, sir. And also at the hearing on August 9th when she was sworn and did testify as to certain matters.
Did she testify on the merits on the?
She did.
Who said, she said, he said type thing?
No, it was Mr. Pachota asked her questions about, I believe, about her, what her medical damages were up to that time and what she projected out that they were going to be. And then after the judge made his ruling, she also, sua sponte, offered some observations as to her opinion as to what her case was worth and whether or not she had agreed to the settlement.
But was there live testimony on, you know, what she claimed she said?
Oh, no, sir. No, sir. It had to do with damages.
Okay.
And if there are no other questions, I don't have anything further to offer.
Thank you, Mr. Abinholt.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Derhagopian, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, sir. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm in the uncomfortable position of being the attorney representing himself, and of course we all know what that means. This is a difficult case. It was difficult from the very start, is because it was a difficult client. Rick Johnson, prior to me, had difficulties with her. Then I had difficulties with her. All of her doctors had difficulties with her, but she needed a lawyer, so I took her case. As we went through his version of the medical record, there are certain things that are left out. That this RSD was first diagnosed some 10 years prior to this accident. There was a rollover accident at 65 miles an hour 6 months prior to this accident, which also triggered the RSD, and the RSD is a progressive disease in any event. So you asked also about the liability issue. The trooper initially put in his report that her speed was a factor. He based that on the fact that there were no skid marks before she hit the semi. They had liability claims. Of course, in my settlement negotiations, I told them that they didn't. But I guess that was actually an issue at trial. It's one that we took into account. Technically, the only issue I'm here to respond to is the legality of the judge's decision to enforce my lien and turn it into a judgment. It kind of subsumes the rest of the arguments because that their objection seems to be based on the fact that either there was no agreement or it wasn't in writing. As far as their actual claim that it was premature, I didn't hear it addressed here today, and I do think in my brief I covered that. And that.
Well, you would concede then, though, if there was no settlement that she acceded to, that you have no lien?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, I might have a different lien, but I would not have the lien on the contract.
Right.
So as far as the premature aspect of it, I think it was premature at the trial court level until after the underlying decision was decided. That was on August 9th. On August 12th of last year, then there was testimony taken, extensive testimony taken on the issue of the attorney lien. Again, Ms. Melstead testified extensively there. There, the judge did find specific findings of credibility. He found that all of her claims of unprofessional conduct on my part were not credible. He found that my statements were credible. There's various reasons in the record why her statements are not credible. And I don't, it's very uncomfortable to attack your own client, even though they're not no longer your client. But there are certain mannerisms and things about her that the regular rules don't apply. You'll see even at the August 9th hearing where she would interrupt her own attorney to tell the judge exactly what was going on and offer additional information. After he ruled, she said, well, there's no way I'm ever going to sign that. In the face, in the judge's face, no, I'm not going to abide by your decision. At the second hearing, well, again, it is uncomfortable. I'm not going to attack my client's credibility.
I didn't hear what you said.
Pardon?
What'd you say?
I said, it is uncomfortable attacking my client's credibility. I think I'm going to leave your...
Well, what is in the record as to what the conversation was immediately preceding the settlement?
In the record, there is only my deposition testimony. It was immediately what happened prior to the settlement. So there would have been this back and forth this Monday before trial. I didn't have anything else going on. I hadn't had anything else going on for a month or two. This client demanded total attention. I provided phone records, showed I'd spent some 2,000 minutes on the phone with her in these last 2 months. Bought her a fax machine so that I could constantly send her all the correspondence. This last offer came at, it was a little bit before 5. Again, we didn't go into the reasons why she should settle at the deposition by agreement of the party. At least it was represented to me that Judge Jensen had said that we wouldn't. I didn't realize that it would again be raised here why there were other, why the reasons why she wouldn't settle. There were certainly reasons why she would. That conversation resulted in this authority to accept $300,000. But the first counter at 325. I did that, it was settled, it was accepted, and that was the settlement. Immediately the next day, I did fax a confirmatory letter, and this is the memorialization of the contract that Judge Jensen specifically relied on as deciding what the terms of the agreement are. That may be important as far as the claim here regarding mistake or that there was no meeting of the mind. The memorialization of the agreement came the next morning. It was immediately faxed to her. Within the following days, other documents were faxed to her, a specific breakdown regarding how much she would get. Again, the numbers here are not accurate, and there is no foundation for them in the evidence except for her testimony, which, unfortunately, she says what she wants to say. It's not necessarily true. Judge Jensen said the same thing at the second hearing. After he'd had a chance to see her a few times, he specifically found that her version of reality is not necessarily accurate. I'm pretty sure that's close to a quote. I'm sorry, did I answer your question, sir?
Well, it's enough.
Thank you. So I think it's the first issue then is the finding of fact itself. I would agree under the prior case law that I think at least my portion of the testimony could be reviewed de novo under the existing case law. She did testify somewhat briefly, so I think his findings on her credibility would probably at least fall under the clearly erroneous standard. There were other claims that appellant made at the second hearing. Again, none of it substantiated. For instance, she claimed that on October 8th, 3 days after the settlement, she spoke to Professor Thatcher at the law school, asked him if this was enforceable. Well, there was no testimony from Professor Thatcher. Clearly, if she did talk to him that day, he would have advised her, he settled without your authority. You must immediately repudiate it. She never immediately repudiated it. She never repudiated it within the first 2 or 3 months.
Was she a law student?
Pardon?
Was she a law student?
No, sir.
Okay.
But living in Vermilion, I guess you're familiar with having those resources handy. The first time she said she was not going through with the agreement was 3 days later. That's what she said. She was not going to sign it. So, well, are you sure? Because I don't have to tell the judge and the attorney for the other side. Well, no, I've got a few things that I want to look into. Apparently, she's always thought there was a second insurance policy and also a second lawsuit that Rick Johnson had thought, that there were going to be multiple sources of recovery, no matter how many times we went through that. You'll see at the second hearing, at the end, she asked Mr. Pechota to cover that ground again. In any event, she prohibited me from responding to the court and to counsel. So in other words, she stopped me from immediately repudiating or at least saying she wasn't going to go through with it. During the course of the rest of my representation and the letters and correspondence to her, it was never repudiated. It was not until the 18th that she said, I'm not going to sign it. And that was the end of that. The first time I learned that she said that it was repudiated, that I had not had authority, was in her affidavit of February of 2005. That was the first time I had noticed that that was her claim. It appears from counsel's statements that he's waiving the argument regarding the requirement of writing, so I'm not going to address that further. I have nothing else that I would like to address. Imagine that you would interrupt me with questions, but perhaps you have none.
Well, we're sorry to disappoint, but I guess you get to quit early.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Pechota, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Not going to take 10 minutes, Your Honor. I think it's, I did in my brief argue that I didn't think it was right to have Mr. Deragopian's lien decided at the same time as the case involving whether or not there was an agreement. And the problem with that is Mr. Deragopian gets to get up like a pro se plaintiff, pro se a party at a trial, and make final argument without nothing in the record being substantiated. I would ask the court to consider this case on the basis of all the stuff that Judge Jensen had on August 9th at the time that he made the decision in this case. There was nothing about Catherine Melstad in any previous hearings or what she said having any relevance to his decision on August 9th. As a matter of fact, he had, if her credibility was so much in question, why would he deny summary judgment in this particular case and require testimony, which he did on a previous hearing before August 9th.
You can't go into credibility on a summary judgment. You couldn't grant summary judgment.
No, I'm just saying that he denied summary judgment previously on the basis of what she had presented pro se.
And well, it would have been improper to grant it.
Okay. Well, I'm just saying that if her credibility was so much in question, he had never expressed that prior to that particular time. At the time of the lien hearing in this particular case, that was after August 9th, and she did testify at the lien hearing, and she really disagreed with what Mr. Deragopian did in this case. She thought that he was unprofessional, and I think the judge was protecting Mr. Deragopian in this case from Catherine's really strident position that he had not represented her properly and then sold her out in this case. What is the problem with a situation like this? Why would you want to cram this down somebody's throat? I mean, all you have to do is say if you're not going to go along with the settlement, let's call the jury back and we'll go to trial. I mean, that's the easiest part. I mean, this case smells when you have an attorney settling a case that has a contingency for $100,000. I just think that it's just not right. And the law and the facts in this case will allow you to reverse this case, and I ask that you do so. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Pechota. Court will be in recess until 10 o'clock.